First, just tell me that people got a little bogged down in unit conversions on the tutorial. When I took freshman physics, I had to do a lot of unit conversions, and then I got to forget about units for a few years and just said C equals H bar equals 1, et cetera. And then when I took cosmology, the units were back. And I passed on that unpleasantness to you without really thinking about it. What I recommend that you do is use the unit converters in, built-in software unit converters in like Mathematica or Python, and then you can think in units where C equals H bar equals 1, and then restore the units with software whenever you need to. So I put instructions, I put it on the wiki now, right? Is
I don't have access to the wiki.
Yeah, me either. Okay. I emailed Gazel, and she'll post soon, I'm sure, an update to the wiki with a little note, just a little example showing how to do unit conversion in Mathematica and Python. Okay. If there are any other... Sorry about the units. It wasn't my intention with the tutorial to make everyone sit and like convert units by hand. If there are any issues like that, this is like me debugging the tutorial. Just let me know, and I can help. Okay, so last time we were talking about random variables and random fields. So just to review a little bit, for a random variable, a scalar random variable, some quantities that come up all the time are the mean and variance, which is the squared size of fluctuations around the mean. These are defined for any random variable. But if the random variable is Gaussian, then these two numbers are all you need to know to determine the entire PDF and any other expectation value you want to calculate. There's an explicit formula for the Gaussian PDF, but it's rarely used in practice. When we do calculations, it's almost always more convenient to just use Wick's theorem to relate higher point expectation values to the 1 point and 2 point expectation values. And that's an equivalent definition of Gaussianness. Just saying that Wick's theorem is satisfying. In n variables, we just have more indices. A multivariate random variable the mean gets now gets a vector index. The generalization of the variance is now a covariance matrix. It's useful to think of this as a matrix and use linear algebra tools. For example, diagonalizing the matrix, has an intuitive interpretation as, in general, the covariance matrix has many elements, n times n plus 1 over 2 elements, symmetric matrix. But diagonalization lets you, is an operation which takes a general symmetric matrix and rotates it into a new basis where the off-diagonals are 0. And so what that would do is line the principal axes of the ellipse up in, with the axes of the coordinate system. In this basis, all the components of the vector are uncorrelated. In the Gaussian case, they would be independent Gaussians. And these eigenvalues can be interpreted as widths here. This would be, I guess, the square root of lambda 2 and square root of lambda 1. Just for fun, in statistics, one thing about working in a field where you have some statistics, some computer science, and so on, these different overlapping fields, is that there's like redundant terminology for everything. So just as a bit of redundant terminology, in statistics, the eigenvectors of a covariance matrix are sometimes called the principal components, and the eigenvalues are sometimes called the principal values. If you hear those terms, they just mean the same thing as eigenvalue and eigenvector. It's just understood that the matrix being diagonalized is the covariance matrix of some random variable. Just for fun, it's useful to try to transport your linear algebra intuition into the statistics context. Here's a question that is probably too hard to be a good real-time class question, but I'll ask it anyway just for fun. Suppose that I told you that I had a covariance matrix of a multivariate random variable with n components, and that that covariance matrix had rank 1. Everyone knows what the rank of a matrix in linear algebra is, right? It's just the number of linearly independent columns. So rank 1 would mean that there's only one independent column, or that is, all the columns are multiples of the matrix are multiples of each other. Now, can anyone offer sort of an intuitive interpretation of what this means about the random variable if I tell you that the covariance matrix has rank 1? If you're not used to thinking about these covariance matrices, I think it's really not obvious. One way that you might think about it is the rank of the matrix is also the number of non-zero eigenvalues. So rank 1 would mean that in some basis, there's only one non-zero entry in the matrix. I can diagonalize it and just get a single non-zero eigenvalue. In other words, and that would mean that the ellipse is like infinitely thin in all dimensions except 1. In its original basis, the matrix may have not many non-zero entries, but they're all related in the sense that, the ellipse is an infinitely thin ellipse with some tilt. The way a statistician might describe the situation is to say that all the components of the vector are 100% correlated. And so that's the meaning of a rank 1 covariance matrix, is it's a random variable, or it's n random variables, which are all 100% correlated with each other. So they're not really independent. They're all just the same thing up to different multipliers. Just an example of how linear algebra, there's sort of a mapping between linear algebra concepts and statistics concepts.
Does this, or could this happen also with a field? In the sense that don't depend on a point or something like that?
I guess if the whole field were a rank 1 thing, that would mean that every field value is 100% correlated, so that the value of the field at one point determined it everywhere else. That would be a rather extreme example of a correlated field. In general, low rank means that there are fewer sort of independent random variables than there appear to be, than there are components in the vector. Then we were talking about random fields. We promote this index into a continuous variable. So a random field in 1D would be a function x of t, which is random. So a realization of that function might be, say, a white noise. You could think of it as a time series. A whole time series, maybe a white noise time series or a random walk. It has some statistical properties. The analog of this equation defining the covariance matrix is this. So there's a, from now on, I'm going to assume mean zero. So assume that the 1 point expectation value is zero. So this expectation value is called the correlation function. And when I say random field, by default, there's an assumption of symmetry. So in 1D, that symmetry would mean time translation symmetry. And so by that assumption, the right-hand side here is a function only of the separation between the two times, the correlation function. I'll show some examples of interesting correlation functions in cosmology on some slides, probably at the end, around the end of the lecture. So, you know, an example of a correlation function in cosmology would be the correlation between the density field at two different points in the universe with some displacement, or the CMB temperature at two points on the sky with some angular separation. If time translation symmetry were not assumed, then the right-hand side here would just be a free function of two variables, just like the covariance matrix is an arbitrary matrix and has two indices. All right. Now, let's think about, so this can be an arbitrary function of the separation. And so if you want the covariance matrix is very, in general, very non-diagonal in this basis, in this position space basis, the correlation function could go out to large separations, which would mean that you have, you know, it has, if I think of its dependence on T and T prime as being sort of like a matrix with some diagonal, the correlation function can vanish far off the diagonal. That won't be true in Fourier space. So I want to think now about how you would represent a random field in Fourier space. So my conventions for the Fourier transform are going to be this. I'm assuming that x of t here is a real field, real valued. Of course, its Fourier transform will be complex because of the e to the I here. This statement that x is real valued in real space does constrain the form of the Fourier transform x tilde. Does anyone know what the statement is equivalent to in Fourier land? So this comes up all the time, and it's a useful thing to know. It says that the x tilde is not a real valued function, but it satisfies this property. The negative frequencies are the complex conjugates of the positive frequencies. If you wanted to see that that was true, you know, you could work it out by just starting. This subject is full of these like short calculations, like two or three line calculations, and sometimes I'll forget to say them. So if it seems like I'm sweeping out something under the rug, just tell me. So let's say we wanted to know what is the condition that this is a real valued field. What does that imply about the Fourier transform? So one thing you could do is just start with this equation and star both sides. So if x of t is equal to x of t star, that's the reality condition. Then if I star both sides here, I get let's write it this way. So x of t star is equal to omega over 2 pi x tilde star. This gets a star, and then when I star the exponential, it reverses the sign. And then on the left-hand side here, I would just have this. So now to compare these, I'll just change variables. W goes to minus, or omega goes to minus omega, to undo the sign flip in the exponential. And now if these are going to be equal, if this is going to be equal to this, the only way that can be true is if this is equal to this, i.e. this condition is satisfied. So this is the reality condition in Fourier domain. All right. Now, let's try to translate this statement that the correlation function, the two-point correlation function, is time translation invariant. Let's try to translate that into the Fourier domain and see what we get. What would happen if I took a function in real space and then I shifted it, if I translated it in time by some amount tau, what would happen to its Fourier transform? What does that time translation operation look like in Fourier space?
Phase.
Sorry?
Just a phase.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. So it, the Fourier transform shifts by phase, e to the I omega tau. And that's easy. That's an easy few line calculation. So now suppose I consider the 2-point correlation in Fourier space. So I correlate Fourier mode omega with Fourier mode omega prime. I want to demand that that 2-point function, whatever's going to go on the right-hand side here, be invariant under this symmetry operation. Now, what the symmetry operation will do is it will bring out an e to the I omega tau and an e to the I omega prime tau. Those just come out as phases. It sort of seems like I'm stuck. Like I have this phase sitting in front. How can the 2-point function end up being invariant under the symmetry operation? It seems like I end up, no matter what I assume about this correlation function, I'm always going to pick up some phase which is not equal to 1. So there's only one way out, and that is that if I rewrite this phase as e to the I omega plus omega prime tau, there's only one way out. There's only one way for the correlation function to end up being invariant under this operation, and that is if the correlation function vanishes. Unless omega plus omega prime equals 0. That is to say, it has to have a delta function on the it has to have a delta function as a factor constraining its support to the line where omega prime is equal to minus omega. Then this phase is equal to 1 everywhere where the right-hand side has non-zero support. I can have anything in front of the delta function. So what comes here is arbitrary. I can always write that as a function of one variable. Because I have the delta function that lets me replace omega prime by minus omega. So this is the most general, we've derived the most general 2-point correlation function in Fourier space. I can have an arbitrary function of, just as in the time domain, the time translation symmetry reduced a function of two variables, t and t prime, to a function of one variable, namely their separation. In the Fourier domain, the right-hand side is a function of just one variable, one frequency omega. Most general time translation invariant. Two-point function. And this function of omega is called the power spectrum. The power spectrum and the correlation function of a random field contain equivalent information. The correlation function is a function of separation that's telling you how a fluctuation here is correlated to a fluctuation here. And the power spectrum is telling you how the amount of power in the field depends in different modes of the field, different Fourier modes, depend on the frequency of those modes. Sometimes the two-point correlation function. Important point I wanted to make is that, so in this basis, let me say one more thing, and then I'll come back to the really important point. Sometimes the correlation, the Fourier space correlation function is written slightly differently with a star on one of the variables. Remember, I'm assuming the field is real, so this is the same thing as x of minus omega, and you would have this on the right-hand side. Minus omega prime. Because it's an equivalent definition of the power spectrum. So the point I wanted to make is that this formula for the two-point function is just saying that the correlation between two Fourier modes vanishes unless the Fourier modes are equal. So all the Fourier modes are independent of each other. This is just like the situation where I had a covariance matrix that was diagonal. If I had a covariance matrix in n variables with a Kronecker delta on the right-hand side times some function with just one of the indices, let's call it lambda I. We have a similar situation here with the Dirac delta function where each Fourier mode of the field is uncorrelated with every other Fourier mode. It's independent with some coefficient that can depend on omega. So in the time domain, a random field or a Gaussian random field looks like some time series which is collectively correlated, some correlation function with an interesting structure. But in the Fourier domain, a Gaussian random field is very simple. It's just a bunch of independent Gaussian random numbers, one for each Fourier mode. So for example, if you wanted to write some computer code to simulate a Gaussian random field, it's very easy in the Fourier domain. You just loop over frequencies omega, and for every frequency omega, you draw a Gaussian random number. It would actually be a complex Gaussian random number with independent Gaussian real and imaginary parts, whose variance is given by the power spectrum evaluated at the appropriate frequency. And that's it. Now you've simulated a Gaussian random field in Fourier space, and if you need it in real space, you just apply a Fourier transform. In fact, that is how the initial conditions of our universe would be simulated on the computer, as I'll elaborate later in the lecture. Part of the standard cosmological model is to say that the initial conditions of the universe, like the fluctuations in the metric, are a Gaussian random field. So if I wanted to simulate the universe, I would just put our Hubble volume in a big box, decompose that box in Fourier modes, and just simulate a bunch of independent Gaussian random numbers, one for each wave number in the universe. Now I said that and you can think of this as like diagonalizing a matrix, how in the matrix case, there was some rotation that took you from a complicated correlation to a bunch of independent numbers. You can think of the Fourier transform as like a big infinite dimensional rotation in a function space. And it's taking you from this basis where the covariance is non-diagonal to the Fourier basis, which is always the basis where the Gaussian modes of a Gaussian random field are uncorrelated. So I said before that the correlation function and the power spectrum contain equivalent information. They're just different representations of the two-point statistics in the time domain and in the Fourier domain, respectively. And that suggests there would be a formula for going back and forth between them. So let's derive that formula. I will start in the, let's start in the Fourier domain. Let's let X be a Gaussian random field with power spectrum P of omega. And let's try to find a formula in terms of P for the correlation function in the time domain. So this sort of calculation is a brute force thing that can be done by just following your nose and turning the crank. Cosmology is full of calculations like this. So let's try to do it. We'll just start with this and plug in the definition of, we've specified the two-point function in the Fourier domain. So let's just plug in the definition for x of t in terms of x of omega. So it's d omega 2 pi x of omega e to the I omega t integral d omega prime over 2 pi omega prime e to the I. In general, when I have a big expectation value with a lot of stuff inside, you should look at, you should consider what parts of the expectation value are random variables and what parts are just constants that are multiplying things. Here, the only random variables are the two x's, and everything else is just a constant, which can always be taken outside an expectation value, or an integral, which can also be taken outside an expectation value. So let me write that out. This is d omega over 2 pi e to the I omega t, e to the I omega prime t prime. I forgot a prime here. Times the expectation value of x omega prime. Now, I'll use this expectation value came out without the star, so I'll use this form of the two-point function to write it as two pi delta of omega plus omega prime. If there were a star, this would be a minus. Times the power spectrum. And then in the last step, I'll just use the delta function to do the omega prime integral. I just set omega prime equals minus omega. The outer integral over omega stays. So this becomes the integral of e to the I omega t, e to the minus I omega t prime, p of omega. And then so final step, let me write that as, let me just collect the exponential here. I'm showing the steps in a lot of detail. Once you do, a few of these calculations, you can omit, start omitting some of these steps. Okay, so the final answer came out. This is the answer. This is the correlation function written in terms of the power spectrum. And the final answer came out a function of t minus t prime only of the separation between the times. That was anticipated because of the time translation invariant. So that's a nice check on the result. What we have is, here on the right-hand side, is the correlation function evaluated at the separation t minus t prime. That's just the definition of the correlation function. So let's rephrase the answer as saying that the correlation function at separation tau is equal to this integral over the power spectrum. In other words, the correlation function and the power spectrum are Fourier transforms of each other. This statement sometimes goes by the name of Wiener. I actually only learned that this was a named theorem like a few months ago. We use it all the time, but I didn't know it had a name. The Wigner-Kinchin theorem. It's just the statement that the correlation function and zeta and power spectrum P of omega are Fourier transforms of each other. Of course, to go the other way from the correlation function to the power spectrum, you just take the inverse Fourier transform. Okay. Let's do some, I want to start like building up some intuition for these correlation functions and power spectra. So let's do some calculations. Let's work out the power spectrum of white noise. So white noise means that I have a time stream where every sample is independent of every other sample. So white noise, by definition, means that the correlation function is a delta function, where there'll be some coefficient in front that parameterizes the amount of noise. So what would the another way of writing this is to say the correlation function at the separation tau is a delta function at tau equals zero. What would the power spectrum be?
Well, if they're just Fourier transforms, then we will get the, the exponential, the tau. E to the e omega tau?
This wouldn't quite be right, because the right-hand side should be a function of omega alone, not right. Doesn't...
So we evaluate
zero. Yeah. Oh, that's right. You were thinking of a delta function at some non-zero offset.
Yeah.
That's right, Okay, so your answer would be right if I plugged tau equals zero into your answer. And then I would just get one, or really eta, because I put this parameter in. The Fourier transform of a delta function at zero, centered at zero, is just a constant. So white noise has a constant power spectrum. The variance of all the Fourier modes, which says that the variance of all the Fourier modes is the same. Here's a fun one. Suppose that X of T is a Gaussian random field. Assume this is a Gaussian random field with power spectrum P. True or false? The derivative of X is also a Gaussian random field. Concretely, all that Gaussianness means for a random field is that in Fourier space, all of the Fourier modes are independent Gaussian random variables with some omega-dependent variance, the power spectrum, which you know can be different for a different random field. What do you guys think? Anyone have a strong guess here? One sort of abstract way to think about it, the answer is yes. I'll just change the question mark into a period. One sort of abstract way to think about it is that, you know, in the matrix case, that this was all the starting point for generalizing to fields, one thing we said that was true was that linear combinations of Gaussian random variables are Gaussian random. Also Gaussian random. And we showed that, or I gave kind of a hand-wavy proof. You know, this is something that's true in great generality. If I just have any matrix or any linear operator, and I apply it to one multivariate Gaussian random variable, I get a new Gaussian random variable that might have a different number of components. Now in this field case, where the indices become continuous parameters, this becomes the statement that any linear operator if I have a Gaussian random field, X, and I apply any operator to get a new Gaussian random field, then the result is a Gaussian random field. Somehow this generalization from matrices to fields, it seems kind of trivial, like you're just promoting I's to T's, but there's something kind of deep about it. It takes a little practice to see how, practice this way of thinking about things, to see how a statement like this, that the if I have a Gaussian random field and I take the derivative, it's just sort of automatic that that's also a Gaussian random field because the derivative is a linear operator. It takes a little practice with this way of thinking about it to see how that corresponds to statements like this. So that's kind of an abstract proof. If you want a more concrete proof, the derivative, you know, a totally down-to-earth way of thinking about a Gaussian random field is that it's just a collection of independent Gaussian random numbers in Fourier space. Let's just think in Fourier space and ask what the derivative would do. Let me call this y of t. How would the Fourier transforms of x and y be related? I'm going to do some board moving. Yeah, exactly. In Fourier space, the derivative just brings down an I omega. If I had a bunch of independent Gaussian random numbers in Fourier space, and that was my x, if I multiply them all by I omega, I'm just multiplying each Gaussian random number by an overall constant. This when I say constant, you know, it depends on omega, but it's not a random variable for each omega. It's just some different constant for each omega. If I do that, and I started with a bunch of independent Gaussian random numbers, I still have a bunch of independent Gaussian random numbers. That's sort of the only thing that's different is the power spectrum or the variance because I put in this factor of omega. How would the power spectrum of y, that's a function of omega, what would that be in terms of the power spectrum of x?
sum of omega squared times tau
squared. Exactly, yeah, yeah, exactly, omega squared. At the level of the field realization, you're multiplying by I omega. The power spectrum is the expectation value of the absolute square of Y of omega. So it picks up, when you multiply the field by I omega, the power spectrum picks up an omega squared. Here's a really fun one. So we did a little calculation to figure out that the power spectrum of white noise was constant. And then we talked about what derivatives do. With those two statements, without doing any calculation, you can figure out what the power spectrum of a random walk would be. So a random walk or Brownian motion, you know, is something that happens all the time in physics. A random walk is an example of a random field where in the time domain, I'm just adding together a bunch of independent Gaussian random numbers as I evolve in time. And each Gaussian random number just represents the step taken in the walk when you go from time t to time t plus dt. So what would the power spectrum of a random walk be? It's not obvious, but there is a way of just sort of inferring it without really doing any calculation from what we've done. I'm just curious. This was too hard for a real-time problem, but I just felt mean. Here's a hint, which is that one way of thinking about the random walk is that's the antiderivative of white noise. White noise just means that I have a time series where every sample is an independent number. A random walk is the cumulative sum of a bunch of independent random numbers. So if I started with white noise and I take the antiderivative, I'm taking a cumulative sum, I get a random walk. What should I put here on the right-hand side?
But if they were really trying to think about the correlation function and power spectrum work, will you transform? And you're saying that the random walk is obtained by the antiderivative of the white noise? Okay. I don't want to say antiderivative of the power spectrum, maybe it's that.
I'm putting you way too much on the spot. Suddenly I feel kind of mean. White noise is a random field with constant power spectrum. And then if I were to take the derivative of white noise, I would get an omega squared. Antiderivative is 1 over omega squared. And so this is the answer. This sort of thing, random walks are everywhere in physics. So you end up seeing a lot of integrals with omega squared in the denominator. You can start to get like some intuition for what the power spectrum represents. I'll show a bunch of pictures in a minute. The pictures really help with giving intuition. This power spectrum is rising. The random walk power spectrum is rising as omega gets small. So compared to the white noise case, you know, the random walk has more power on long, at large Fourier wave numbers or long timescales, which just sort of means that the random walk, can accumulate a big displacement over large time intervals, and white noise can't. Here's a fun. I have a bunch of sort of systematic pictures of random fields with different power spectra, but. It's going to take more than 15 minutes, so I'll save them for next time. Here's a One fun example that sometimes comes up is that it is claimed, so the intermediate case, where you have a minus one power of omega, is sometimes called, so in the most common term for this, this comes up so often that it has a bunch of names. Sometimes it's called pink noise. In electrical engineering, it's called 1 over F noise. In physics, I think we would call it scale invariant noise. So I'll prove this in a minute, but a Gaussian random field with this power spectrum, it's some sort of wandering Gaussian random field, which is sort of halfway between a random walk and white noise. And it has the property of scale invariance. If I were to take a random field with this power spectrum and take a small subinterval of the plot range and zoom in on that interval, it would look statistically indistinguishable from the original. It's claimed, I never really tried to like verify these claims myself, but it's claimed that this is sort of everywhere in nature. For example, if you take music, you take an MP3 file and take its loudness as a function of time, that's a time series. And if you take the power spectrum of that time series, supposedly, you tend to get this 1 over omega exponent, regardless of like what genre of music it is or what culture of people made it and so on. You know, another example of a phenomenon that shows 1 over F noise is like tides. Over long time periods, the height of tides rise and fall. And that rise and fall over time is modeled pretty well by this type of 1 over F behavior. Or drifts in electronics, things like gain drifts and amplifiers. That's where we see them all the time in like observational cosmology. Here's a fun example that has been coming up lately in my research. Suppose you take the power spectrum of noise in a radio telescope. So I have a big dish. It's pointed at some blank part of the sky. And I collect the radiation at this antenna, put it through some amplifiers, put it across a resistor, and just read out the voltage on this resistor. That's a time series. That voltage, you know, has a time dependence. And it, you know, wanders around with time. It has some noise-like properties. Here's what its power spectrum would look like. I just think this is a fun example. So it'll end up looking something like this. If I ignore the spikes for a minute, then the first thing you see is the sum of terms which are, there's a constant white noise. The noise looks like the sum of a white noise contribution with a constant power spectrum, and then a term that goes like 1 over omega, so some 1 over F noise. And the way we interpret that is that this voltage has some thermal noise, things like just thermal radiation in the environment falling into the telescope, just thermal fluctuations in the resistor itself. All of those thermal things, they don't really have memory. They're just white noise, random fluctuations that are independent from one time to the next. And then we have a bunch of things that are like drifts, like the gains in these amplifiers drift around with time. The ground voltage that this resistor is connected to slowly drifts. And if this telescope is looking through, say, some turbulent atmosphere, that turbulent pattern drifts around with time. All of the drifty things in the universe that go into this measurement are what we call the 1 over F noise. Just for fun, these spikes are at 60 hertz is the frequency of like AC power in the electric system of the walls. And because there's electronics all over the site that are running on that power source, there's just a lot of radiation in the environment at 60 hertz in its harmonics. This example I thought might be kind of useful as a way of getting some intuition for what a power spectrum represents. Let's do. I had a bunch more calculations that I was going to do with random fields, but I feel like it might be more useful just to have you guys practice them in a tutorial. Since I have like 5 minutes, I'll do one. So here's another example. Let X of t be a Gaussian random field with power spectrum p. So suppose that I make a new random field y by boxcar averaging x. So what I mean is I have my random field x. And then I just, I want to smooth out. Suppose I want to smooth out these high frequency wiggles. So I average it. I take moving averages with some width tau. Formally, I define y to be the time average of x taken over a window of time tau separated at time t. So y is a random field. It evolves with time. Let's just, as an example, calculate the power spectrum of y in terms of x. Again, it follows by just linearity that if x is a Gaussian random field, so is y, because this is a linear operator. The point I'm trying to make with this example is that if anyone in the class were to just try to calculate this by brute force using no particular tricks, then you would get the right answer. We'll start with the definition of y, and then plug in. Well, maybe there's a little trick that's useful. I guess the trick is, before calculating the power spectrum, to see how the Fourier modes of y are given in terms of the Fourier modes of x, like at the field level, how they're related. So let's plug in x of t. That's going to be the integral of, let's write it in Fourier space. I said I was going to use. Reverse the order of integration. We'll bring the t integral to the inside and do it. So I'll bring the omega integral on the outside. If I integrate e to the I omega t, I'll write this as a separate thing. Sorry, this should have been t prime. If I integrate e to the I omega t prime between these endpoints, then the result can be written like this. Sine omega tau over 2 divided by omega tau over 2 times e to the I omega t. From this you can read off that on a mode-by-mode basis, in the Fourier domain, The Fourier modes of y are given in terms of the Fourier modes of x by multiplying by this factor. By the way, both differentiation and boxcar averaging are examples of operations that are simpler in Fourier space than they are in the time domain. In the Fourier space, they're like diagonal in the sense that they just multiply each mode, each Fourier mode by some constant. That is true generally for any like time translation invariant linear operator. The reason that the answer is coming out this way is because the boxcar averaging, as I defined it, doesn't have like a preferred time, but it's time translation symmetry. So now by the same argument that we used for the derivative, the power spectrum of y is just the square of this factor times the power spectrum of x. The function in brackets here is equal to 1 in the limit of small omega if omega is much less than 1 over tau. And it goes to 0. It falls off, you know, as 1 over omega squared with some oscillatory envelope in the limit where omega is large. What that means is that this boxcar averaging process is keeping all of the power below some characteristic scale and suppressing it on wave numbers that are above some characteristic scale. And that's just what you would intuitively expect. If I have a a high frequency mode, it gets washed out by the boxcar averaging. But if I have a mode whose wavelength is long compared to the time scale of the boxcar averaging, then it's not affected. I guess that's it for today. I think every time I teach this stuff, somehow the math seems deceptively simple. Like the formulas are not very complicated, but when you do calculations or think about the examples, there's some sort of different way of thinking that takes a little bit of getting used to. Tomorrow, more random fields, and I'll show a lot of pictures.